Case number 11-1302 et al. EME Homer City Generation LP Petitioner versus Environmental Protection Agency. Issue 1, issues raised by state petitioners and EPA's response. For the petitioners, Mr. Davis. For respondent EPA, Mr. Rave. For state and local respondent interveners, Mr. Frank.
Good morning. Judge Griffith, a member of this panel, is ill, but he will be listening to the argument through his computer. Council may proceed.
Good morning, and may it please the court. Under the Clean Air Act, EPA may promulgate federal implementation plans, or FIPS, only in accordance with Section 7410(c)(1). Here, EPA exceeded its authority under that provision with respect to a majority of the transport rule FIPS for the 1997 standards. EPA also exceeded its authority under Section 7410(k)(6) in its effort to correct that problem. EPA's contrary contentions overlook its successful request on rehearing in North Carolina to keep CARE in effect pending the promulgation of a valid replacement. I'd like to focus on Sections 7410(c)(1) and K6 and begin with C1, which is the sole source of EPA's FIP authority.
If North Carolina hadn't done that, what result?
If the initial decision in North Carolina is all we had and a mandate issued from that vacating CARE, then EPA would have a good argument, I would think, under the Rivers Doctrine that that would apply. But what happened, of course, in North Carolina is that EPA made the request and the court granted it to keep CARE in effect. And so the upshot of that was that CARE defined the applicable requirements of the good neighbor provision, and that is significant because of Section 7410(k)(3), which requires EPA to approve a SIP if it meets the applicable requirements of the Clean Air Act, here the good neighbor provision.
I mean, an interesting situation given our precedent where you have an environmental statute or a statute affecting public health, where we have said rather than go back to square zero, as it were, will continue in effect on this interim basis what exists. So does the Rivers Doctrine then have no effect?
It does not have effect when the disposition of the court is not to vacate the rule. And that's what we have here. The court took the affirmative step.
So under Rivers, there must be a return to ground zero. I just want to be clear about this. In other words, this court clearly held in North Carolina that, and initially vacated the rule, because it did not meet the requirements of the statute.
That's right, Your Honor.
And it was on this interim theory that the court, at the request of EPA and the states, left CARE in effect. And the agency argues, well, left it in effect only for purposes of the trading program. At least that's what it says in its brief now.
Well, the court left CARE in effect for all purposes, and it did that to preserve the environmental values of CARE. Mm-hmm. And the effect of that, again, was that CARE controlled, it defined the good neighbor obligations, and that's why we had EPA approving CARE SIPs both before and after North Carolina. Mm-hmm. Those CARE SIP approvals were compelled by Section K3, and they were not in error at the time they were made, and I'd like to talk about that more in the context of K6. Mm-hmm. But I also want to talk about C1. And
right, isn't C1 the problem in the sense that North Carolina means, in essence, as Judge Rogers says, that the state hadn't corrected the deficiency?
Well, here's what EPA is arguing. It's saying that the deficiency in Section C1's unless clause refers to the deficiency that the court identified in North Carolina. But that doesn't comport with the text of the statute. The deficiency in Section C1's unless clause refers to the text immediately above it. It is either a C1A, failure to submit any SIP whatsoever, or a C1B, submission of a SIP that EPA disapproves. EPA's reading of the deficiency is separate and apart from that text.
So if the statute doesn't plainly address this situation and has left a gap for the agency to fill, what's your argument?
We don't believe that there's any gap here because the deficiency clearly refers to a C1A or a C1B.
Well, you're going to make the timing argument, as I understand it, but the court has already held that CARE was invalid.
The court said that in its initial opinion, but it did not issue a mandate to effectuate that result. And in fact, its mandate effectuated the opposite result of keeping CARE in effect. And that's why Section K3 applies here and requires the approval of those CARE SIPs. If I could move to Section K6, which is the corrections provision. This is an important point because even if EPA is correct about what corrects the deficiency means in Section C1, it's still needed to rely on Section K6 here. And that's because EPA had on the books CARE SIP approvals on which states relied that said these states have satisfied their obligations under the Good Neighbor provision and we no longer have FIP authority. And so it had to do something to get rid of those findings. And what it did here is remarkable in one sense in that it tried to have two contrary things at once. Instead of changing the CARE SIP approvals to disapprovals, it merely rescinded certain statements in those findings. And so what it did was say on the one hand that the CARE SIP approvals were still made, and it did that because it needed to keep implementing CARE at the direction of this court. But it rescinded the statement saying that the CARE SIP approvals had ever even, I'm sorry, the CARE SIPs had ever even been submitted in an effort to reach back to the 2005 finding of failure to submit any SIPs. So it's premising its transport rule FIP authority on a C1A finding a failure to submit. And of course, those two things are inconsistent with one another.
But what you refer to as remarkable strikes me as perhaps an accurate characterization had there been no North Carolina decision. That they're trying to deal with that, right?
They are trying to deal with that, but there is another provision in the Clean Air Act that gives them the mechanism to do that here, and that is Section 7410 K5,
right?
The SIP call provision. That would have allowed EPA to say...
That's why it really goes back to how we interpret North Carolina, I think, and you, I think, started with that, and you're hinging a lot, maybe everything, on the fact that it wasn't vacated.
That's correct, Your Honor, but we would say, though, that EPA did need to rely on K6, and if I could make two textual points about K6. The first is the phrase, was in error. And this ties in with the argument that I began with. The CARE SIP approvals were not in error at the time they were made because they were compelled by this court's decision on rehearing and mandate in North Carolina and Section K3. Even assuming, however, that EPA could clear that hurdle, it would next confront the in the same manner language of Section K6. And here, it's undisputed that the CARE SIP approvals went through notice and comment rulemaking in the same manner in Section K6 means that any corrections of those approvals also have to go through notice and comment rulemaking. And they did not. And EPA's response on this point is that it can rely on the good cause exception from the Administrative Procedure Act. But that's not the case because under the text of 5 U.S.C. 553b, the good cause exception is not available when notice or hearing is required by statute. And that's what we have in Section K6 through the in the same manner language. Even assuming, however, that EPA could prevail on all of the points I've already mentioned today, it still couldn't rely on the good cause exception here because it cited only the unnecessary prong of that exception. And as this court has said in Mack Trucks, cited on page 10 of our reply brief, that prong of the good cause exception is limited to actions that are routine, insignificant, inconsequential, and here that is certainly not the case. And the reason it's not the case is because if EPA had complied with the statute and gone through notice and comment, the states would have pointed out the points that I've just made this morning, that under what the court said in North Carolina and its mandate in Section K3, EPA was required to approve those care SIPs, and that its only option was a SIP call. And that's significant to the states because under the Clean Air Act, states have the primary responsibility to address air pollution. They do that through SIPs. That's critical to the states because they get to determine through SIPs how to allocate the burden on their sources. And if EPA comes in and imposes FIPs, it bypasses that important protection of the Clean Air Act. Mm-hmm. Now, in our view, this error should result in vacature of the entire rule because it takes out 31 of the rule's 59 FIPs. Now, EPA says that's okay. The rule can still function as intended. It's hard for me to see how, if you take more than half the rule out, that could be the case. But even so, that argument overlooks a couple of things. One, it draws an artificial distinction between pre- and post-North Carolina care SIP approvals. And as we say, as we note in our brief, if you eliminate that artificial distinction, the ozone season NOx trading group, for instance, goes from 20 states to 5, and it's hard to see, and I'm not sure whether EPA would even say that trading group can function as intended with 3/4 of the states removed. The other point is that this argument ignores all of the other points that the states have made in their brief and the industry petitioners have made in their brief. And if we take all of those points, we feel that there's not enough left of this rule to allow it to function as intended. And in my remaining time, if I could just address briefly one of those points, this is point 2 in the state's brief, and that is the requirement under North Carolina to give independent significance to the phrase interfere with maintenance in the good neighbor provision. This court held that EPA must do that in its replacement to care, and EPA did try to do that, but it never defined what interfere with maintenance means, and in imposing cost-effective controls, it created a rule that could require states to go well beyond what they need to do, that is upwind states, to ameliorate interference with maintenance in downwind areas. And the only break on that was cost, and we know from the Supreme Court's opinion that that's not good enough. EPA has air quality limits that it must account for under the good neighbor provision, and in footnote 18 of the Supreme Court's opinion, the court explained that under the maintenance prong, EPA's statutory authority is limited to reducing just enough to eliminate those threats to downwind maintenance. We've also pointed to the example of Allegan County here as demonstrating how EPA's methodology for identifying maintenance sites doesn't square even with its own determinations. Here, the Allegan County maintenance site, EPA confirmed, would have no problems maintaining the ozone NAAQS through 2021. And EPA did that through approving Michigan's maintenance plan and noted that that was true even without the benefits of care, and that any maintenance problems could be resolved through contingency provisions. Those are in-state measures in Michigan's plan. Those are the points I intended to cover. If there are other questions, otherwise I'll reserve the remainder of my time for rebuttal.
Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. Norman Ray from the Department of Justice. With me at council table is Jessica O'Donnell, who will present argument in the second part of the argument, and Stephanie Hogan and Kate Trutting from EPA's Office of General Counsel. If my speech is a little slurred this morning, Your Honors, it's because I'm recovering from Bell's palsy, a condition that causes a paralysis in half of the face. I don't think it'll be an issue, but if I need to repeat something, please let me know. The petitioner's challenges to the transport rule should be rejected. They're inconsistent with the Act, with the Court's opinion in North Carolina, and with the Supreme Court's opinion. Petitioners claim that EPA's approval of CARE SIPs precluded promulgation of the transport rule FIPS. It's clearly inconsistent with what this Court actually did in North Carolina. In North Carolina, in its opinion, the Court made explicitly clear that CARE was not sufficient to satisfy the upwind state's obligation to eliminate their contributions to interstate transport of pollutants, because, among other things, CARE imposed no controls on interstate trading, and the allocations of allowances, both of SO2 and NOx, were not related to the state's contribution. It therefore found in multiple ways that CARE was invalid and that it did not address the state's significant contribution obligation.
So let me be clear. In your brief where you suggest that the only reason, strike only, but the reason the Court acted as it did on rehearing was to enable the trading program to proceed.
I don't believe we did said that. We said that, Your Honor. We certainly didn't intend to convey that impression.
All right.
The reason we sought rehearing in the case was to avoid what we saw as both economic and environmental problems that would result from vacature of CARE. Environmental problems because while CARE was flawed, it did achieve substantial reductions in emissions. And economic issues because there'd already been significant banking and trading of allowances up to that point.
So, and at least as I recall, some of the states were concerned that the attainment dates were fast approaching and they had already invested in the controls necessary to meet those.
That's right, Your Honor. Many of the petitioners actually, not all, but at least a number of petitioners in that case did in fact support not vacating the rule in the states. But it was not kept to maintain the trading program. The trading program is part of CARE, so we certainly asked the Court to maintain CARE in its entirety, but it was not the trading program per se. It was because of the environmental benefits, which in fact have resulted from CARE, and because of the economic issues. We simply asked the Court to exercise its equitable discretion in fashioning a remedy to allow EPA to continue to implement CARE while it promulgated a replacement for the rule, and that's explicitly what the Court said it was doing in its rehearing order. In fact, it explicitly stated that CARE must be replaced, that CARE must be replaced expeditiously, and warned that the Court would entertain a mandamus petition if EPA failed to do so. So there is simply no way that order on rehearing can be read as reversing the Court's findings that CARE was invalid, and that CARE did not constitute a meeting the state's obligation to address interstate transport. And therefore, because CARE was invalid, the CARE SIPs were invalid, because there were two parts to the CARE SIPs that EPA approved. When EPA approved the CARE SIPs, the primary purpose of approving those SIPs was to allow the states to implement CARE within the state. That allowed them to do two things. It allowed them to change the allocation of allowances to sources within the state. And it also made them responsible for ensuring that sources within the state complied with CARE. That is, that at the end of each year, they had enough allowances to cover their emissions. That was the purpose of promulgating the CARE SIPs. No, it was not based on any independent analysis that the states had demonstrated that they had met their interstate transport obligations. It was based solely, before the decision in North Carolina, it was based solely on CARE and on the findings that EPA had made in CARE that if states complied with CARE, they would meet their obligations. After CARE, it made clear that it was obvious that the CARE SIPs did not meet the state's interstate transport obligations. The court has said them so. The court has said that CARE did not meet their obligations. And therefore, that, to the extent that the CARE SIPs had found that the states had met their obligations, they were invalid. And
so
that
is
also.
This all C1?
Yeah.
Yes, the states, most of the CARE FIPs were based on a finding of failure to submit. And what, after CARE, it was clear that the states had not submitted a plan that would address their interstate transport obligations. In fact, they hadn't submitted anything. After North Carolina, I'm sorry. So therefore, because the states had not met that obligation, and that was the deficiency. The deficiency was that the states had not submitted a plan to address their interstate transport obligations. That's what the court, EPA, found they had failed to submit. That was the basis for the CARE FIPs, and that's what triggered EPA's FIP obligation. And because CARE had not met that obligation, and because that portion of the SIPs were in error, EPA's FIP obligation remained as to all of those states covered by CARE.
There's obviously debate about K5 versus K6, but
yes.
I'm wondering if your position on this issue were to prevail, do we even have to say anything about K5 versus K6, or is this all North Carolina plus C1?
Well, Your Honor, we think there are two independent grounds on which the court could uphold EPA. One is just exactly that it's C1 plus North Carolina. And that was, that's really sort of our primary view, is that EPA's obligation under the FIPS had not been discharged by CARE, so EPA continued to have a statutory obligation. C1 says that EPA's FIP obligation is met only if the state submits a SIP, that only if the state addresses the deficiency and EPA approves a SIP. So we certainly agree that if the court agrees with that, it does not have to address the 1K5 and K6. I'm sorry, Your Honors.
Mm-hmm.
However, EPA did, sort of as an abundance of caution, did decide to go through the corrections process and to correct only that portion of the CARE SIPs where EPA had made a finding, implicit or explicit, that the states had met their obligation, because that part was clearly in error after North Carolina. North Carolina says multiple times in the opinion that CARE was deficient because it did not ensure that each state eliminated its significant contribution. So EPA then invoked its authority under 110K6 to correct that portion of the SIPs. It did not, there was no reason to correct the administrative portion of the SIPs to keep the states from administering CARE and allocating allowances and checking with compliance. But
on both of these arguments, I'm worried about the unintended, unforeseen repercussions of anything we might say. Obviously, I think North Carolina is very significant to this part of the argument. But on the C1, how often does it happen that there's a situation like the one we have in this case? In other words, a court, the finding of deficiency, the SIPs are approved subsequently before the FIP, but then a court decision comes in afterwards, kind of pulls the rug out from all that.
I think it's probably pretty unusual. I'm not aware of any situation on those fours, because this is a somewhat unusual program where EPA develops a region-wide set of requirements or determines how to address a problem on a region-wide basis, implements it initially through a FIP, and then gives states the opportunity to submit SIPs to take over administration of the program. So it's a fairly unusual circumstance, Your Honor.
Whereas the K5, K6 strikes me could open up a lot if we relied on that ground. But correct me if I'm wrong. In other words, your view on K6 does seem like it could be something that has, again, my concern about unforeseen, unintended repercussions of what we say here.
Well, it's certainly the situation that comes up more often, Your Honor, where EPA determines that a SIP approval was an error for one reason or another and invokes K6. And, you know, the argument has certainly been raised in other cases as well that it should have raised, should have used K5 instead. It hasn't been litigated.
On the K5, K6, how are we supposed to make sense, just if we were to get into that, how are we supposed to make sense of where the boundary is between K5 and K6?
Well, they do overlap. There certainly are circumstances where EPA could utilize either one. K6 applies. K6 is actually more limited than K5. K6 applies only where the SIP was in error when it was promulgated. So there has to have been an error at the time. And it could have been an error that EPA should have known about, or, well, arguably should have known this one too. But certainly the error here is that the EPA believed that CARE met the state's obligations.
But can't you always or almost always, through creative lawyering, say it was an error at the time, even though it was based on something that happened subsequently?
Not always, Your Honor, because, I mean, I suppose in theory, but, you know, more often K5 is a situation where, and K5 comes up in another number of circumstances. It comes up where there have been subsequent regulations that states have to incorporate into their SIPs, and it comes up where, you know, the facts have simply changed. You know, everybody projected air quality to improve to a certain extent, and it didn't for some circumstance.
And on that latter circumstance, is that an inappropriate circumstance for use of K6?
I mean, I think it may depend on the facts, Your Honor, but in that situation, EPA would generally, my understanding, uses K5. K6 is generally used where, you know, there's just sort of an obvious technical error, or where there was some error of law in doing that, and therefore it uses K6. And there may be circumstances when EPA could choose to use either one. It would depend on, and we have to have discretion. You know, here it used K6 because of, because it was obvious that it was an error, and there was nothing the states have argued they should have had notice and comment, but there's nothing they could have said. The court spoke very definitively that CARE was an error, therefore the SIPs were an error, and nothing the states could have said was going to change that. And also there was a need, as the court had pointed out, to expeditiously replace CARE with a new rule, and therefore K6 was simply a much better choice to move forward, to get a program into place that met the court's requirements from North Carolina and that addressed the needs of the downwind states to get the reductions they need for attainment. Are there any other questions on that issue? Let me just briefly then say on the issue of maintenance. You know, EPA did here in this case define which areas needed reductions from upwind states in order to avoid maintenance problems. They did an analysis, a modeling analysis using variations in weather patterns, et cetera, to identify those areas that specifically were at a high risk of coming into non-attainment, that were currently had clean air quality, but, you know, given, you know, predictable changes in weather patterns, might well come into non-attainment, and then only it brought into the transport rule those states that made a significant contribution, defined as more than 1%, the same threshold it used for non-attainment. So it did exactly what it was required to do. It identified those non-attainment areas that were at risk of coming in attainment in the near future, and then identified those states that made a significant contribution and imposed controls on those. So there is limits. It certainly complies with this court's requirement that we address it independently. In CARE, EPA had only, and it said this explicitly, EPA had only used the attainment, the interference with maintenance prong of the statute to justify continuing controls on areas that had previously contributed to the same area when it was in non-attainment. And the court found that, you know, simply making that prong of the statute sort of an appendage to the non-attainment prong was inappropriate, and that EPA had to independently look at whether areas that are in attainment but sort of right on the border need help. And that's what EPA did here. It did that modeling analysis. It decided which states made a significant contribution, and then it used the same level of determine the same, use the same matrix for determining the level of control, which the Supreme Court said was also within EPA's discretion. So EPA did meet all of the statutory and case law requirements for addressing the maintenance issues.
So your argument is it complied with North Carolina in that respect, and the Supreme Court said you had considerable discretion in this area, and that your argument is it's a reasonable interpretation of what is required. Do you have any response to the argument about what I'll call double counting? In other words, if the downwind state is assuming that the upwind state contributes to 10% of its problem as to a particular pollutant, that the measurement of what is required from an upwind state should only be in excess of that amount, if you understand I'm getting it.
I'm not quite sure I do, Your Honor, but...
As I understood the argument, it was sort of that, given that the downwind state has already taken into account a certain percentage of out-of-state pollution coming into the state, that therefore any obligation on the upwind state as to maintenance could only be as to the amount that exceeded what the downwind state had already assumed in its planning.
Right. The problem with that, Your Honor, is that those assumptions and those maintenance plans are based on care, mm-hmm. and care has to be eliminated. So mm-hmm. what we have to do is figure out what the world's going to look like without care, mm-hmm. and therefore, and then determine based on no care. So they can't, you can't say, well, there are the maintenance plans, which are based on care and these other programs, show that they'll stay in attainment because care is going away. And therefore, what EPA had to do was look at what's going to happen in the real world in the no-care situation, which is, you know, the situation we have to face to eliminate care, and determine whether they need continued controls, and those continued controls are those that are imposed by the transport rule.
But theoretically, just so I understand it, ignoring care is the agency's interpretation of interference with maintenance consistent with not double counting?
Yes, Your Honor, because EPA based it on actual modeling of air quality. They did the same kind of analysis it did for non-attainment areas. It looked at current air quality. It modeled what it would anticipate air quality to be under a range of scenarios in these areas and determined, you know, including all the controls that the state had imposed, all federal controls, you know, all existing controls other than the transport rule, and decided that notwithstanding all these other controls, these areas were at risk of non-attainment and of going back into non-attainment, and therefore and then determined that there were, in fact, upwind states that significantly contributed, and therefore determined that those upwind states had to reduce their emissions in order to ensure that these downwind states should remain in attainment. I mean, at bottom, Your Honor, there's really no reason to have a different sort of analysis for areas that are just below the NAAQS as it is for those just above. In both cases, the upwind state contributions are needed to make sure that, you know, particularly given variability in weather patterns, et cetera, that the areas are able to maintain over the long term. If the court has any, does the court have any questions on any of the other topics in the state's brief?
All right. Thank you very much. Okay. The interveners, state and local?
That's correct, Your Honor. For the state and local interveners, including North Carolina, Andrew Frank. May it please the court. I plan to address the error correction and the interference with maintenance issues. As regards error correction, EPA's use of the error correction provision here was fair, reasonable, and lawful. Once this court determined in the initial North Carolina decision that it could not pick and choose any parts of care to preserve, and then ruled that the entire rule was unlawful, as well as the care FIPS, everyone knew or should have known that the CARE SIPs were also unlawful. When the court subsequently issued its reconsideration order, that was an order on remedy, not on the merits. And all the court was doing there was exercising its equitable powers to allow EPA to continue to implement an unlawful but beneficial rule pending the amount of time necessary for EPA to correct those errors and promulgate a new rule. In terms of interference with maintenance, EPA's interpretation of the interference with maintenance provision was also fair, reasonable, and lawful. EPA gave independent effect to that provision. That's why there are 15 states that are designated for pollution controls for interference with maintenance, but not for significant contribution for ozone. Once EPA corrected the SIP approvals, it fairly and reasonably and lawfully used FIPS rather than a SIP call. A SIP call would have introduced unnecessary and unreasonable delay. This court had said that it did not intend to set an indefinite delay on its substantive mandate in the North Carolina decision, and that was consistent with the court's concern with prompt and lawful emissions controls, as reflected in its previous order or decision, that there was a necessary connection between the upwind state's good neighbor obligations and the downwind state's maintenance deadlines. If, however, some of the upwind states feel that's unfair for them to be operating under the FIPS, the rule gives them the opportunity to submit SIPs to replace the FIPS. Mm-hmm. The rule has given them that opportunity since August 2011. My understanding is that no state has taken up that opportunity yet. So to turn back to the interference issue, it's the downwind states and cities that suffer when an upwind state interferes with maintenance. The downwind states, if an area reverts back to non-attainment status, they have to impose additional pollution control requirements, not only, say, on power plants, but on other industrial and commercial activities. They have to impose pollution offset requirements. And, of course, it's the people who live in those downwind areas who suffer the increased adverse health effects from the increased pollution. EPA reasonably and fairly interpreted the interference with maintenance provision to eliminate, eliminate most of those risks. It determined which upwind states' emissions caused those risks, and then it eliminated the increment of those states' emissions that caused those risks. And so for most of the downwind areas, those risks were eliminated. Council said that EPA chose those emissions reductions based solely on cost. That is not correct. In fact, one of the real positive changes in this rule as opposed to CARE or the NOx SIP call is that EPA did choose the emissions reductions based not only on cost considerations, but on the air quality considerations. So when EPA reduced the emissions for interference with maintenance, it did so only so far as necessary as to bring the above average, the risky air amounts, the risky air quality in the downwind states beneath the NOx. And so there is no over control here because there was a different parameter involved. My time is almost up, so I will close. The stakes for clean air in the downwind states are high. This rule reasonably, lawfully, and fairly interpreted the good neighbor provisions, and upholding the rule would allow the downwind states to finally enjoy the air quality benefits that this 2011 rule provide. And if the court has no further questions.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors.
On the C1 issue, we agree that the initial opinion in North Carolina said the CARE was flawed. But the problem is the court didn't give effect to that holding. It instead kept CARE in effect. And this is not a matter governed by Rivers, but rather by the text of Section 7410. And to emphasize again, it's Section K3, which states that EPA shall approve a SIP as a whole if it meets all of the applicable requirements of the Clean Air Act, here the Good Neighbor provision. The applicable requirements were defined by CARE, and the court's affirmative action of keeping CARE in effect meant that that was what defined the applicable requirements. So that's all we're saying here, is that under Section 7410, EPA had no choice but to approve those CARE SIPs. Judge Kavanaugh, you asked about the K-5, K-6 issue and suggested the court may not need to reach it. I think the court does need to reach it. And the reason for that is what I mentioned in the opening, that because the CARE SIP approvals were on the books and everyone relied on them and they said the states have done all they need to do under the good neighbor provision, it couldn't just be obvious to everybody that that was wrong. EPA needed to get rid of those in order to clear the way for FIPS, for these states under the good neighbor provision.
Why wasn't it obvious?
Well,
after North Carolina?
It wasn't obvious because of the rehearing.
Okay.
And because the court kept CARE in effect. And the answer here is a SIP call.
But wasn't the contemplation of North Carolina that there'd be a replacement rule in short order and the court, in fact, encouraged, might be a light word for expeditious.
That's right. And here's an important point on that. The SIP call would not create unreasonable delay or really any delay because EPA could have rolled out a SIP call on essentially the same schedule it had here. If shortly after North Carolina came down, that's January of 2009 for the mandate, EPA had issued a SIP call saying, once CARE goes away, these SIPs are going to be substantially inadequate. You need to revise your SIPs. Under K-5, you can give states up to 18 months to do that, or a shorter time if it's reasonable.
But remember, let's not forget history here. The states were arguing they couldn't do that because they first had to get their budget set by EPA, and EPA couldn't do that until it figured out what this replacement rule was going to be.
That's right, Your Honor, but EPA consistently took the position that it could do that. And because it was taking the position
But you're representing the states here, so I'm just trying to get clear what your position was then as opposed to now in terms of criticizing EPA's alternative view of what was lawful under the statute.
The states may have made that argument, but the Supreme Court later confirmed that EPA was correct on being able to
right.
call
but for
SIPs.
Right, but all I'm getting at is you're saying there wouldn't be any delay because EPA could have issued a SIP call back at the time of North Carolina.
That's right.
Yeah, okay.
On interfere with maintenance, Judge Rogers, you asked about our argument based on the emissions that were already accounted for downwind. And the response I heard was that, well, the maintenance plans relied on CARE. But that's not correct. And the Allegan County maintenance plan, the approval of that, confirms that. It says very clearly that CARE doesn't enter the picture here, that the NOx SIP call is doing all the work from the upwind states that's needed.
Can I ask on the K-5, K-6
sure.
again? If what's wrong with EPA's view that a court decision that says the administrator's determination was in error qualifies or satisfies K-6? In other words, that would be a limited holding that a court decision provides the impetus for showing that it was in error at the time.
Right. I think if we had the initial decision in North Carolina and a mandate flowing from that, that would make sense. But again,
it's all about the remand. I mean, the rehearing order.
Yeah. That's right. And K-3. It's the combination of those two.
Mm-hmm.
The court keeping CARE in effect and K-3 saying the applicable requirements mm-hmm. are met. Therefore, you have to approve it.
Okay.
If there are no further questions. Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the Court. I'd like to begin, if I may, with our as-applied over-control challenges. And the dispute that remains between the parties on that issue is a dispute not about the facts, but about the law as stated by the Supreme Court. Section 1 of our opening brief identified those specific states that we contend have been over-controlled, and our showings are based exclusively on EPA's own data. And EPA doesn't deny, as a factual matter, that each of the states we've listed could be regulated significantly less, and every downwind location to which they are linked would still attain and maintain the NAAQS. EPA instead disputes that that's the legal test for determining overcontrol. But that's exactly what the Supreme Court said. And to quote the operative sentence from the court's decision, if EPA requires an upwind state to reduce emissions by more than necessary to achieve attainment in every downwind state to which it is linked, the agency will have overstepped its authority under the good neighbor provision to eliminate amounts that contribute significantly to non-attainment. That's exactly what we've shown to be the case with respect to those states. EPA hasn't denied that it's the case, and EPA's argument here is really simply fighting the Supreme Court's test in, I think, two different ways. The first is that EPA notes that after saying, as the Supreme Court did, that the test is whether the reductions are more than necessary for attainment in every downwind state to which it is linked, the court a few sentences later says that reductions unnecessary to achieve attainment anywhere are unlawful. But the Supreme Court used those two formulations interchangeably because they mean the same thing. EPA's list of all downwind locations to which a given upwind state is linked is the list of all downwind locations for which the upwind state either contributes significantly to non-attainment or interferes with maintenance. The upwind states don't affect any other location within the meaning of the statute. So when we've shown that those states have been required to reduce by more than necessary for each downwind state to which they are linked to attain and maintain the NAAQS, we have shown that those reductions are more than necessary for attainment anywhere. It's the same thing. The other argument that EPA makes is that it is entitled to use uniform cost thresholds nationwide, even when using those uniform cost thresholds means that some states will be over-controlled, as the Supreme Court stated the test. That's a highest common denominator theory in which if at least one or perhaps a few states need to be controlled at $500 a ton, then all states can be controlled that way because uniformity nationwide is allowed to trump. But that theory really is at war with the Supreme Court's instruction, which it issued at EPA's behest, that these over-control issues be addressed and resolved through as-applied challenges to individual state emissions budgets. EPA asked for that remedy as an alternative to this court's across-the-board uniform invalidation of the rule. And inherent in an as-applied challenge to an individual state emissions budget is that if that challenge is meritorious, the remedy will be an adjustment to that individual state's emissions budget, which will mean there will be some departure from nationwide uniformity. And it really isn't open to EPA to oppose the uniform across-the-board invalidation of the rule that emerged from the panel's last decision and urge the Supreme Court instead to have this issue addressed through as-applied challenges. And then when we bring meritorious as-applied challenges that require changes in individual state emissions budgets, to say that's unacceptable because then there would be no uniformity across the states. And in fact, it's quite clear that this is how the Supreme Court understood it, because Section 2C of the Supreme Court's opinion, which is where this is addressed, begins by saying that EPA's use of, quote, uniform cost thresholds, ellipsis, thus left open the possibility that an individual state would be required to reduce more than necessary for attainment in every downwind location to which it's linked. It went on to say that that type of overcontrol would be unlawful, but that the way to address it is through as-applied challenges to an individual state's emissions budget, which is exactly what we've brought. So if I may turn, unless there are questions about our overcontrol challenge.
Well, suppose you're right on everything you said there. How does it work in terms of what we say as to particular states?
Let me break that down then for your honor. First, the easiest in some respects are the 14 ozone states we've described in Section 1C. Those are states where EPA projected at the outset of the rulemaking that all of the downwind locations to which any of those states are linked would attain and maintain the NAAQS in 2014, even if there were no, zero good neighbor controls on the upwind states. It went on, nonetheless, to impose budgets on those 14 states. For those, the remedy is, I think, a straight vacature. There is no ground for imposing budgets on 14 upwind states that are linked exclusively to locations that EPA projected in 2014 would fully attain and maintain the NAAQS without any good neighbor controls.
All right. Then, and just so I'm clear, that's the 2014 budget.
That's correct, Your Honor.
We're in, and I realize that's all your brief has addressed, but just so I understand, what happens for 2015, 2016, 2017?
Well, the 2014 budgets are the ones that are, you know, in effect going forward. So what they call the 2014 budget goes on until they change it.
And that's what I want to understand. Who changes it?
Well, EPA, if the rule had never been challenged and it just went into effect as planned, then the 2014 budget would just keep on being
until
in effect
EPA until EPA notifies the state. And I just want to be clear.
Right. Probably what would happen is, you know, the NAAQS are themselves being revised.
All right.
That, you know, there are different things that even when, I know the history of the good neighbor provision has been, you know, a series of rules in some cases because of, you know, this court's decisions. But even if there weren't this court's decisions, there would be a need through intervals of time to update it. So, for the 1C states, Section 1C, I mean, Section 1C of our brief, that would be straight vacature. For the states we address in 1A and 1B, which are Texas,
Those states, just so I'm clear, would have no good neighbor obligation.
Yes, because EPA has projected that they're exclusively linked to downwind locations, which will attain and maintain the NAAQS, even if there are no good neighbor obligations on the upwind states that are linked to them. Now, the other four states, which are Texas, Alabama, South Carolina, and Georgia, and we address them in sections 1A and B, that is a different story because it is not our contention, for example, that Texas should have no emissions budget. It's our contention that it should be a higher emissions budget, but that there is still a basis for controlling Texas under the good neighbor provision. So to take Texas and PM and explain the remedy with respect to that, EPA said Texas is linked to only one downwind location, Madison, Illinois. And EPA said at the outset of the rulemaking that if every upwind state linked to Madison, Illinois were controlled at $100 a ton, Madison would fully attain and maintain the NAAQS. It nonetheless regulated Texas at $500 a ton. What we would propose for states like Texas where the emissions budget should be changed is that the court remand without vacating because we're in the middle of a compliance year, there's allowance trading going on, we understand the disruption of vacating something completely in the middle of the year, but it should be remanded so that Texas's emissions budget can be revised upward to take into account the Supreme Court's overcontrol holding.
Upward to what, though?
EPA's own data shows that Texas could be controlled at $100 a ton, and Madison would still attain and maintain the NAAQS, so that's what we think the level should be. And that's, again,
about on the ozone.
Yeah.
On the ozone, they'd have to do more work, because the ozone showing, they did not break out ozone the way they did PM to show $100, $200, $300, $400 a ton. So we cannot point for ozone to a specific number in their rulemaking that establishes conclusively exactly what it should be. What we do know about ozone is that Texas was linked solely to two downwind locations, Allergan and East Baton Rouge, and those locations attained at the level of emissions that Texas was emitting and all the other upwind states linked to them immediately prior to the transport rule. Well, nonetheless, EPA says somehow those states need to reduce their emissions from that level even further in order for these states to attain the ozone NAAQS. We know that's not true, but we can't give you a number. That would have to be a remand without vacature in which EPA would have to recalculate the budget based on the Supreme Court's principle.
So when EPA has to... ozone comes back and says its modeling shows that as to the East Baton Rouge receptor, that Texas is a contributor to maintenance problem. Is that just something that would be worked out on remand?
Like any of these things, it would be worked out on remand, and if we were unhappy, you know, we could file a petition for review and complain that the resolution was arbitrary. But, you know, Your Honor is correct that on that one point, they are relying on their modeling, which we challenge as part of the second argument.
I know. But you started out by saying EPA doesn't even challenge. Well, on that one, it challenged. But I just want to go back as to the $100 under CARE. Were you suggesting in response to Judge Kavanaugh's question that this court should say we remand with instructions that the budget be modified to reflect $100 as opposed to $500, or just leave that to EPA?
No, I would not suggest that the court would be that prescriptive, Your Honor. I think what I would imagine the court would say if we were to prevail on this issue would be EPA's data at the rulemaking showed that if all upwind states linked to Madison were controlled at $100 a ton, Madison would still fully attain and maintain the NAAQS. It's remanded for EPA to, in light of that, to come up with a new emissions budget, and it would certainly be open to EPA, if we've missed something, to come back with some other factor that they want to argue about, and we could challenge it and all that. But we're not saying this court orders them to do it at $100 a ton. But whatever it would be a lot less than the $500 a ton that they imposed on us simply because, you know, they were looking for uniformity and didn't agree that they had an over-control limit. I mean, that's what is striking about going through this rulemaking. They generated all of this data at the outset, which demonstrates things like Madison would be controlled at $100 a ton. All the ozone states, those 14 states are linked to, need no good neighbor controls. And they didn't look at it. They didn't do anything with it. They didn't consider it. They generated all this data that we've cited in our brief. And then because they didn't agree, I mean, this court said in its last opinion that EPA took no steps to safeguard against overcontrol. And it's not surprising that if you don't believe the obligation exists and you take no steps to comply with it, then you will find at the end of the day that there are quite a few states where you have inadvertently overcontrolled. And that's what we're asking to be corrected.
We say the same thing then under your theory for Alabama, Georgia, and South Carolina?
Yes. Yes. Those states, when you do the exercise with them, they come up differently.
Yes.
You know, one state at 400, one state at 100.
Do that exercise.
Right.
My sympathies, Your Honor. yes, I mean, it can be different. For none of those states, is it $500 a ton?
Yeah. All right.
And then Louisiana's mentioned in the state's brief.
Yes, I don't think we have raised a challenge with respect to Louisiana, at least not with PM, okay. And I don't think we have as one of the ozone states either, but I'm not certain of that.
Okay.
To turn to the issue of air quality modeling, EPA relied on data from 2005 to try to project what air quality would be in 2014. And commenters urged it to look at the most recent real-world air quality data in order to see whether its projections were lining up with what was going on in the real world. EPA declined to do so, and had it done so, it would have had to confront the fact that its projections were producing things that really made no sense. And
let me ask you, I mean, you've read EPA's brief. They respond with an explanation, and you take issue with the explanation. And there's several explanations. But given our standard of review and deference on these questions, so intertwined with agency expertise. The fact that EPA decided to compare using a data set other than the data set you have identified, why is that consistent with our standard of review to say that EPA modeling must basically be reversed as arbitrary and capricious?
Sure. Let me address that, Your Honor, because we certainly understand that this is an area in which agencies get a certain amount of latitude and deference.
Lots but, from this circuit.
Excuse me, Your Honor?
Lots from this circuit.
Yes, although in the Appalachian Power case that they cite for that proposition, in fact, the matter was remanded to the agency to give a better explanation because the court said the stark disparities between real-world data and what the model was showing required more of an explanation than the agency had given.
And but here the agency gave explanations. That's why I started where I did.
That's right.
You take issue with the explanations.
I would say the explanation was clearly arbitrary for this reason, Your Honor. Mm-hmm. We showed that, for example, in nearly half of the locations that EPA looked at, EPA was saying that when upwind emissions would be further reduced from current levels, pollution concentrations in downwind areas would go up. Mm-hmm. Now, that should have been a hold the presses moment when the agency says that is so unusual.
But from the agency's perspective, they had an explanation for that because the transport rule is different than CARE.
What?
It's you know it as well as I do. How does the court deal with that?
It deals with in this, and we're not suggesting that the court would rewrite the model or prescribe what the agency.
Yeah.
But here is what the court would say.
Find it's arbitrary.
Yes.
And capricious.
And here is what is arbitrary about it, Your Honor. They're obligated to give a reasoned explanation for why they refuse to look at what we think was clearly probative data which would show that their projections were making no sense. What was their explanation? Their explanation was we can't look at that data because that data is impacted by CARE. CARE has been declared unlawful and it's going to be replaced. So we can't look at the most recent air quality data because that was impacted by CARE. That is not a reasoned explanation because that data was factual data that established a relationship, a verified real-world relationship between the level of air quality level of emissions reductions upwind and the air quality.
Two different regulatory schemes, says the agency.
But it doesn't matter that's what they say, and that's what we say is arbitrary. They say we can't look at it because it was an old rule that was declared invalid. But whatever the reason why upwind emissions were reduced, whether it's CARE or an economic recession or anything else, whatever the reason, that's irrelevant because it's still the case that we all learned from CARE that when upwind emissions are reduced to this, downwind air quality is that. And if you refuse to look at it and refuse to confront the fact that, my God, when we use our model, we're projecting that when upwind emissions are reduced more, downwind pollution concentrations go up. Whether the upwind emissions were at the level they were at because of CARE or anything else doesn't change the fact that there was a factual relationship between here's what upwind emissions are, here's what downwind air quality is. So all we would ask Your Honor to say, and we're not saying the rule should be vacated on this argument. Again, this would be a remand for them to look at the data, which they have refused to look at, for the arbitrary reason that it was impacted by CARE, and then they could come back and say, we've looked at the data and we realize we now have to change some of our projections, or they could come back and say, we have a better explanation. That's always open to them.
Well, isn't this an ongoing process for the agency, too, as it's going on each year here and looking at... Or how does it work?
It's actually not. It's not. I mean, these 2014 budgets are it until they initiate a new proceeding because they've decided it's now on the regulatory agenda to update the transport rule. So we are stuck with this until there is a new rulemaking, and we don't think we should be. If there are no further questions, if I may reserve the remainder of my time.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
May it please the Court, my name is Jessica O'Donnell with the Department of Justice. I'm here today on behalf of EPA. The Supreme Court endorsed EPA's cost-based approach to determining upwind states' significant contributions to their downwind neighbors' air quality problems. EPA's emissions reductions required by the transport rule are based on reasonable cost thresholds and require emission reductions that are no more than necessary to address the downwind air quality problems that the agency was aiming to fix. Petitioners' arguments do not show that EPA went beyond its statutory authority in the Good Neighbor provision or it otherwise acted arbitrarily in establishing emissions budgets. I'll also address petitioners' challenges to EPA's modeling,
On the main argument,
yes.
What do you do with the section of the Supreme Court's opinion that talks about the as-applied challenges? Because it wasn't obvious if the Supreme Court was going to rule with the agency in EME Homer as it did, that it was going to include a section like that. But it did include the section like that, and it really comes right out of oral argument, it seems, and the briefs as well. But oral argument, Justice Sotomayor asked a question, and then Chief Justice Roberts asked a specific question to EPA's counsel, including the over-control argument, or would that have been done? And the answer to that was, no, that wasn't done, I'm paraphrasing now, and by EPA's counsel representing to the Supreme Court and the Chief Justice in that answer that these challenges would be available. And that would mean that there would not be uniform cost thresholds. And so it seems to me that you told the Chief Justice one thing and coming back, and then that's in the opinion. You can see a direct line, I think, if you look at this, between that colloquy and the opinion, and now you're coming back and you started by emphasizing the uniformity. As applied challenges are inconsistent with uniformity.
I don't think that as applied challenges are entirely inconsistent with uniformity. I think that, and I don't think the fact that the Supreme Court mentioned that there were the possibility of as applied challenges meant that those as applied challenges would necessarily be meritorious as applied challenges.
And
I think that petitioners.
No doubt. I agree completely, but there is the possibility, or let me just ask you this. There is the possibility of as applied challenges in which a successful as applied challenge would have a different cost threshold for a particular state than other states have, correct?
I would not go so far. I would say that there is a possibility. I don't think that anything in the Supreme Court's opinion requires EPA to set an individualized cost threshold for a particular state, which is what the petitioners here are asking for. In fact, I think that would be contrary to the primary holding of the Supreme Court, which is that EPA's use of the cost thresholds
So I might agree with you that there's some, and Justice Scalia certainly pointed this out, there was some tension between that section of the court's opinion and its main holding. But obviously the court, whether through compromise or whatever, came up with an opinion that said, yes, you can use uniform cost thresholds, but also have as applied challenges.
And the touchstone for the court in terms of determining what might be over control would be the downwind air quality, whether those downwind areas were meeting the NAAQS or were maintaining the NAAQS. So I think that if you had, what the Supreme Court was saying in Section 2C was if you had a group of states or a single state that was linked to one downwind receptor, and it was a completely closed universe of upwind and downwind linkages. In other words, no other upwind, there would be, you know, the other upwind states would not have other downwind linkages, which is exactly the situation that you have with Texas and Madison. Madison is the only downwind linkage for Texas. However, Madison has numerous other upwind contributors, all of whom contribute to other downwind states. The Supreme Court specifically recognized the interwoven and connected nature of the causation problem that EPA was trying to solve, and recognized that that uniform cost thresholds were appropriate to the extent that they did not require an upwind state to reduce its emissions more than necessary to achieve attainment in any downwind state.
To which it is linked.
Well, I recognize that language is in the Supreme Court's opinion. I think
that's critical.
It's like the most important phrase the opinion on this part of the issue. To which it is linked.
I think petitioners are putting too much emphasis on that language. I think that if you look for, I think that language has in mind the examples that the Supreme Court, the hypothetical situations the Supreme Court was discussing throughout the opinion, which all involved the situation that I described, where you have a closed universe of upwind states and downwind states, and not the situation like you have with Texas, where there are other upwind linkages that have downwind air quality effects. And if you change the cost threshold that would apply to Texas and those other upwind states, which is not the same, by the way, would have ripple effects on the downwind states that are attached to those other upwind states.
I mean, your brief makes the point that it might affect the training program, but the rule itself already has non-uniform cost controls.
That's right, Your Honor. And I would say that, even assuming that petitioner's reading of the Supreme Court opinion is right, I think ultimately EPA's application of the cost thresholds and EPA's development of the cost thresholds has to be judged by a reasonableness standard. The Supreme Court also said that EPA must have leeway to balance its obligation to avoid over control with its statutory duty to maximize downwind non-attainment and maintenance. EPA here did take into account, they did essentially what petitioners are asking them to do. They took into account the magnitude, the possible differences in the magnitude of the downwind air quality problem that might be facing different sets of receptors and upwind linkages, and applied a lower cost threshold to those states who were where the downwind problems were resolved more easily. The $500 per ton threshold represents, the level that EPA determined all downwind problems for those states would be met. But as Judge Rogers noted, EPA also established a $2,300 per ton threshold for states who were linked to higher downwind areas where they had more intractable air quality problems.
But that cuts against your argument is what I'm suggesting here, and I need to understand why it doesn't. You've already acknowledged that. Now, as I understand the argument that's being made that you're protesting here is that uniformity of cost thresholds is a principle that is critical to a reasonable interpretation of the statutory requirement. But I don't see you arguing that, and let's take the Texas example, that were the Texas budget increased, as counsel was discussing, that somehow that would throw out the calculation as to whether or not there will be attainment or interference with maintenance. I mean, nothing changes other than that state's budget. Otherwise, your scheme remains in place.
Well, I have two responses to that. One is that we do disagree that Texas has shown that it's all of Madison's downwind problems would be resolved at $100 per ton threshold.
That's not its argument, as I understand it. I mean, as I read your brief, you were saying, and I think that's perhaps why counsel started with that, anywhere discussion. Your notion is that at Madison, because there are hypothetically five states contributing, Texas is only one, therefore there's this magic balance that's been developed in concluding that Madison will attain. And yet, the only argument is looking at EPA's own data, it shows that same result will occur even if the Texas budget is increased.
Well, that petitioners are relying on analyses that EPA did at the proposal stage. EPA changed the inputs and it did not reflect how the analysis that EPA did was not the same as the analysis that EPA did at the final stage for in terms of applying the cost thresholds to the states. For example, I don't believe EPA was applying both the NOx thresholds and the SO2 thresholds at the same time or at the same level.
So that's out on remand.
So that's one difference. I think
that in your brief. That's all.
The other problem I think that is if you the problem with saying that you can just increase Texas's emissions budget is really twofold. The first is what do you do with the other states who are linked to Madison who are paying the $2,300 threshold and who are required to do that because of other linkages that they have?
They still
do
have
you
to do
lower
it.
That? Do you lower their
no.
Threshold?
No.
So, but then how do you analyze
the answer, right?
I think that changes the analysis of whether if you lower the cost threshold for Texas, but the other states remain constant, then that area would still attain.
Exactly.
And Texas would not be doing the work. The area would attain based on the emissions reductions of those other states.
They have the higher budget because of their linkages to other downwind states or receptors, apart from Madison.
That's right, but the Supreme Court recognized that an incidental benefit of having an area exceed attainment doesn't necessarily rank as over control.
No doubt. If you have linkage to A and B and you can't reduce one without pulling one below attainment, pulling the other below attainment, then you have to keep with the higher number. And that would be the case of those other hypothetical states you're talking about who are linked to Madison. They have to stay hypothetically at 2300 because of the linkages to other state downward receptors that they have, right?
That's right. That's right. And so if Texas is Texas doesn't,
and that's the whole concept of the as-applied challenge, I think.
Well, and the second problem, well, then I will turn to the second problem that will occur if you, or with lowering Texas's, the cost threshold. If Texas's costs, are lower, that means that, I mean, because you're not just looking at, it's not just that the cost thresholds apply uniformly, but you're looking at the electricity grid. And my understanding is that if you lower the cost threshold, and this was part of EPA's rationale for establishing the uniform cost thresholds and applying them the way that they did, and limiting the number of cost thresholds that you could have. If you lower the cost thresholds, with regard to Texas, that will decrease the cost of generation in Texas, which means that generation will shift there and emissions will increase there. And that will have ripple effect on downwind areas. So you can't just lower the emit, you can't
Wait,
just.
Start, repeat that last sentence, if you can. The ripple effects part.
That will have ripple effects elsewhere. If you, and with regard to Madison, I mean, if you increase Texas's, if Texas's emissions increase as a result of having lower costs, that will have an adverse impact on the air quality in Madison, the area to which it's linked.
But it won't pull it below attainment.
If the emissions are greater, if the emissions are greater than what EPA anticipated,
based on
a $500 per ton cost threshold.
Based on EPA's own data, even if Texas's budget is increased, Madison will still attain.
Based on EPA's analysis for the proposal, it indicated that a 100 per ton threshold could potentially resolve the downwind problems. EPA changed the inputs into the models between proposal and final, so we don't know if that still
is true. I can only imagine the battles that would happen on remand. But in any event, taking that data as it is, if the 100 were the right number, Madison will still attain even if, and just take the hypothetical for a second, if 100 is the number that was in the data, and Madison would still attain even if Texas were given $100 a ton.
I don't know if you could say that because the emissions budgets were based on also the projections of electricity usage. And if electricity usage is increased in Texas because the cost is lower, that will change the ultimate output the ultimate emissions levels in Texas.
Where will I find this ripple effect analysis?
Well, I think that is an interesting, good point that you raise, Your Honor, because this issue about applying applying lower cost thresholds to certain states is not something that was raised below or that EPA addressed.
But the Supreme Court,
information
was raised above,
oh, right.
Which is more important.
At the agency's invitation.
With regard to the ripple effect, I think that you,
in other words,
I could point you to the portions of our brief that discuss what will happen.
Not your brief. When I was preparing for this case, what I was looking for was a theory of uniform cost controls, and I thought there might be a technical document somewhere that might explain this. I didn't find that, and in your brief, I didn't find the argument that sort of this is a house of cards and you pull out one and the whole scheme collapses. So at this point, all we have is the data that EPA produced, its conclusions. And with that, it may be a jump to the conclusion that increasing Texas's budget will not have an effect on attainment and maintenance. But there isn't anything that
causes, at least on the record we have before us, that I have found that causes me to doubt that at this point in terms of a remand.
I think the best discussion that I could point you to would probably be EPA's discussion of the cost thresholds and the different factors that it analyzed in terms of looking at those cost thresholds. But that doesn't address this.
I saw that.
And that would be at,
but that's it.
48256 through to about 260. That doesn't address, it does, I admit that it does not address this particular issue. But,
the ripple effects too, I mean, just to go back to the Supreme Court, Justice Sotomayor asked the question about the as applied. Then the Chief Justice says, including the over control argument, or would that have been done? Okay, that's the point where EPA counsel could have said that would have been done because of ripple effects, et cetera, what you just said. That's not what was said. What was invited there to the Supreme Court was the concept of as applied challenges for over control. No mention of ripple effects or anything like that. And then you see it in the opinion. So I'm concerned about a theory that was presented to the Supreme Court and now a new theory that's presented to us that would be inconsistent with what the Supreme Court relied on, I think quite clearly relied on in that section of its opinion. So I've said that a couple times, but that's a concern I have about at least taking your position right now as opposed to remanding for further, obviously you can come up with new analyses, new data on remand.
Right. If there are no further questions on that topic, I'd like to move on to the petitioner's argument with regard to the ozone, the states affected by the, or the states that petitioners claim should now, the states where petitioners are claiming the rules should be vacated because the 2014 base case projections show no attainment or maintenance problems with no controls. I'll be honest that it has been somewhat unclear to me the argument that petitioners were making. I mean, in their opening brief, petitioners, I think, said no. They argued very clearly that the rule should be vacated with regard to those states. In their reply brief, they seem to suggest that they have no, they abandoned any claim that EPA did not properly determine that those states did contribute significantly to downwind non-attainment and maintenance in 2012. The rule is based on EPA's air quality projections for 2012, which show that all of those states have significant contributions below, above the threshold to non-attainment and maintenance issues. And so, and petitioners abandon any claim that EPA appropriately made that determination or included the states in the rule for that purpose. It seems that petitioners are now arguing that EPA should have concluded that EPA should not have imposed any requirements on them, on those states, notwithstanding their downwind contributions because of what EPA's projections showed with regard to 2014. That is inconsistent with what the statute requires. It's inconsistent with what this court required in North Carolina, and it simply wouldn't make any sense to run a regulatory program assuming that you could lift emissions reductions based on something that may or may not occur in the future. EPA imposed the requirements starting in 2012 based on its
If the projections show for a given year that attainment will occur and maintenance will occur even without any good neighbor obligation in certain upwind states, doesn't that mean that EPA is without authority to impose good neighbor obligations on those particular upwind states?
The 2012 projections show that those states would.
But the 2014 projections show that they wouldn't, right?
Right. But EPA was basing the requirements of the rule based on the 2012 projections. And so therefore EPA had the statutory authority to include them in the rule. If petitioners thought that, or if the states think that, and I think that, Council for Petitioners even recognized this, that once you're in a regulatory program, you're in. If an EPA properly included the states, and petitioners don't really contest that here.
When EPA is setting new budgets for a particular year, if it's established that your upwind emissions are not contributing to any non-attainment or interference with maintenance in a downwind state, EPA, just because they're, quote, in, doesn't mean they can still impose a good neighbor obligation, correct?
I think that if the state thought that circumstances, if the state thought that circumstances were changed in 2014, they could submit a proposed SIP to EPA to be removed from the FIP. I mean, I think that would be the appropriate course. People don't get out of regulatory programs, regulated sources don't get out of regulatory programs based on future projections. I mean, if they were, say, for example, it was a facility that was obtaining a permit for NSR, non-attainment NSR, the facility, the permit requirements would not be lifted on the facility just because the area was redesignated from attainment to non-attainment. There would have to be some sort of a process for purposes of changing, if it was appropriate, those permit limits. I'll also point out
this
that
sounds arbitrary to require a good neighbor obligation if the good neighbor obligation is not necessary for the particular year, and all we have are projections for a particular year to achieve attainment in the downwind state.
Well, EPA didn't base the budgets on the projections, as far as I understand. EPA did not base the budgets for those states on the 2014 projections. EPA, you know, based the budgets on information in the 2012 base case. The 2014 projections that petitioners were relying on were not used for any regulatory purpose in terms of developing the rule. They were simply something that EPA prepared for purposes of the regulatory impact analysis. So it wasn't, EPA didn't rely on them in establishing emissions budgets.
So spin this out for me. As I understand, your argument is that when EPA projected the budgets for 2014, in 2012, it found significant contributions. The regulatory system is such that what happens in 2014, where EPA's, just take this as a hypothetical if you wish, the data shows there will be no significant contribution, there will be no interference with maintenance.
I think if the data
show, does the state just drop out, or you're saying no, the state has to submit a SIP to say we are in compliance and therefore
the state would have to submit a SIP, and there's an important reason for that. In order for downwind states to rely on any of the emissions reductions that are obtained by the transport rule or any rule under the good neighbor provision, those reductions have to be permanent and enduring. And so the downwind states could not rely on emissions reductions if EPA were only going to leave them in place for 2 years. If the circumstances have, that's why I say if the circumstances have changed, and the upwind state can show that they are no longer significantly contributing to the downwind state's air quality problems, they could submit that in a revised SIP to EPA. But I'll note that if they did that, they would have to show that they wouldn't be interfering with any of the applicable requirements, including the new, any additional interference with any additional or more stringent NAAQS that EPA could have promulgated in the intervening time. Here, we know EPA has established a more stringent 2008 NAAQS for ozone. And so.
So your understanding of the regulatory system is if State A was subject to the transport rule because of significant contributions in year one, but by year 10, State A is no longer making significant contributions. According to EPA's own analysis, State A continues to be subject to the rule until State A submits something to EPA?
Well, I don't think that you can say that it's based on EPA's own analysis. I mean, I know the projections say what the projections say, but EPA did not undertake those projections for purposes of establishing the requirements for the rule. So ordinarily how it would work is that once you're in the rule, you would not drop out unless the state could show, and I'll remind you that this is initially the state's obligation to submit the SIPs, EPA to address their downwind contributions their contributions to downwind air quality problems. EPA is promulgating the rule here because the states have had a long-running failure to address those problems. And so EPA is, it's not required by EPA under the statute to determine how long, on the horizon those problems will persist. The states have the ability to submit, if the states think that there is no longer a problem and that they're no longer contributing to the downwind state's air quality problems, they're permitted to, they're able to submit a SIP to replace the FIP. In fact, they're permitted, they're able to do that at any time.
And I gather no state has. From what council said earlier.
State has no state has submitted any proposed SIP.
To get out from under 2014
That's
or
right.
any other budget
no.
year.
No. I see that my time is up. I just had one point to make about the EPA's air quality modeling. And that is EPA did not refuse to look at I'm not going to go over the point that, EPA, I think the court understands EPA's point that CARE is simply, there's no technical basis, there's no reason you would compare results under CARE with the results that EPA was projecting under the transport rule because they're simply not the same rules and they're not the same they're not the same allocations of emissions. The methodology is different, so I'm not going to address that further. The point I did want to make, though, is that EPA did not refuse to look at the recent air quality data. EPA said that it was not going to validate or test the model using that data because that would be inappropriate. But EPA did look at that data, and EPA said that it's not simply a linear relationship between emissions levels and downwind air quality. There are other factors that affect EPA's that affect that relationship, meteorology being one of them. And EPA noted with regard to final rule with regard to the 2009 data that yes, EPA recognized that there was unusually low design values during that time period, but that was affected in large part by the meteorology at the time. And so you can't simply assume that emissions at a particular that there's a linear relationship between the emissions. And that's the final point that I wish to make.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Hello now. Public health, respondent interveners.
Yes, good morning. May it please the court. Graham McCann for the public health interveners. If I may, I'd like to briefly address the 2014 base case issue, as well as one quick point on the overcontrol issue. First, on the base case issue, if you look at the same 2014 base case projections that were described in industry petitioners footnote 13, they list six downwind receptors where they say those locations would be underneath the attainment or maintenance threshold in 2014. Those same projections, however, show that those six downwind receptors would all be in violation in 2014 of the 2008, the more stringent 2008 ozone NAAQS of 75 parts per billion. They all had design values above 80 parts per billion. Achieving the health-based NAAQS is the core focus of the Act. And it would have been an affront to this goal if EPA had disregarded this data in front of it, showing that there were going to be remaining non-attainment issues in 2014 under a newer standard, and allowed states contributing to that problem to increase their emissions. At page 48219 of the preamble to the final rule, EPA said it is mindful of the need to provide for continuing ozone progress to meet the 75 part per billion level of the 2008 ozone NAAQS. And in not releasing upwind states of their obligations, their budgets in 2014, that was in a reasonable approach to that data in front of it. The other point I'd like to make is that the approach urged by industry is inconsistent with the Clean Air Act's emphasis on keeping pollution controls in place, at least until an area violating the NAAQS shows that it has actually attained the standard due to permanent and enforceable reductions, and that it will stay clean for 10 years. And that is structure is outlined in 7407D3E of the Act, 107D3E of the Act, which is alluded to in industry respondents' brief at footnote 1. I'd also like to point out on that point that the EPA, at page 68 of its final rule, Emissions Inventory, TSD, it says that the 2014 base case modeling included projected economic changes and fuel usage for EGUs in the mobile sector. So these were not, you know, locked-in benefits in 2014, absent good neighbor reduction. These were, you know, the vagaries of the economy, industrial changes, natural gas prices, and that is not a basis. That would be inconsistent to rely on that basis for relieving upwind states of their pollution reduction obligations would not be consistent with that. If I see my time is over, I just had one point to make on the overcontrol, if I may.
Yes.
I think industry petitioner's argument with regard to Texas provides an incentive, sort of a free rider. This is a collective action problem that a thorny causation problem that the Supreme Court recognized. And if, for future rulemakings or even, you know, looking at, the time when EPA has to act, it looks at all upwind states having to act simultaneously to reduce their emissions. So why is Texas the first in line to get their reductions accounted for to Madison, as opposed to the other group two states that also contribute, are at the $500?
The other states can't reduce it without it causing a problem in other downwind receptors.
And so if you sort of pull on individual threads, as the industry petitioners have, rather than acknowledging the interwoven and overlapping connections in this rule, then you provide an incentive for, in future rulemakings, for the court to say, well, for each state to say, you know, I'm not going to fulfill my good neighbor obligations as set forth in the statute, as required by the statute, within my border. Each state must address its emissions within its borders, because I'll just see how it's going to play out with all the other states. And so there's this dynamic that it could lead to if you accept the petitioner's argument.
Can you play that out? Because that's an important point. But it's not in the Supreme Court opinion, so that's a first problem, but that's a legal problem. But I'm more interested in just the real-world significance of what you're explaining and how that would play out. If you give me a concrete example of what you're anticipating.
So I would disagree that this dynamic is not in the Supreme Court opinion.
Not in the key section. Which may be inconsistent with the other section of the opinion, which is, I think, your point, but we have to follow. Try to follow all the sections.
So I would point to the Supreme Court's approving citation to the legislative history at 1595 of the Supreme Court's opinion, where they talk about going from the prevent standard in the 1977 version of the good neighbor provision to the contribution standard in the 1990 provision. And in that report, they said, it's impossible to say that any single source or group of sources is the one which actually prevents attainment downwind. And this is the contribution problem. And so Texas would say, you know, we have modeling to show that Madison, despite the fact that we contribute above the 1% threshold to Madison, Illinois, at year three after a new NAAQS comes out, they say we're going to sit on our hands. We're either going to sit on our hands or we're going to make a demonstration to EPA that says Madison, Illinois' air quality problems will be addressed just as well by Indiana or Missouri or Wisconsin. We'll show you that modeling. So we don't have to submit or we can submit a plan laying out this rationale for why we don't have to make any reductions. But every state is required to act at that three-year deadline after a new NAAQS issues. And so there's this dynamic of each state saying, oh, if I can just, if another state contributed to that same problem also makes the reductions, then I'm off the hook and I don't have to meet my statutory burden to address the emissions from within my own borders that contribute to this problem downwind.
Okay. Thank you.
Nothing further.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Industry respondent.
May it please the court, Brendan Collins for the industry respondent interveners, and our clients are profound champions of the use of allowance markets to deal with the problem of interstate pollution and other environmental problems that can be so managed. I'd like to address a few of the panel's questions about the tension and the implication of uniform costs versus the shifting pollution burdens that are talked about. And I'd like to begin actually by directing the court to page 48263 of the Federal Register, Joint Appendix pages 332 and 333, and also a somewhat later section, 48271 of the Federal Register, pages Joint Appendix 340 and 341. Because these frame the tensions that the difference between using uniform costs and the difference between using different costs for different states pose on this model. And I want to make sure that before I leave the podium, all the court's questions on that issue are answered. When uniformity means, uniform costs mean that one would expect to find uniform allowance prices in Texas, in Pennsylvania, in Alabama. And when uniform allowance prices exist, what it means is that power plants in all those states compete on a level playing field. That's important for air pollution as well as it is for economics. Electricity takes no heed of state borders. When power demand exists, power demand is answered by the power plant that can generate that electricity most cheaply. And cheaply, in this case, includes what we call variable costs in the industry, including things like allowances that you're going to have to buy to emit the pollution that you're going to emit when you make your energy, or offsettingly, and very importantly and critical to this rule, the actual costs you incur to run your scrubber or to run your selective catalytic reduction equipment in order to eliminate the emissions, which is, of course, what EPA wants people to do. And that's why it chose a price to begin its modeling efforts that would be sufficiently high so that it would yield an allowance price which was sufficiently high so that plants would say, I'm going to run my scrubber because I can do that cheaper than I can go out and buy an allowance. And guess what? If I buy an allowance, I still emit a ton of pollution. If I run my scrubber, I don't. So only when I run my scrubber do I have an ameliorate the downwind impacts of my operation and generation of electricity. Sorry, just Judge Rogers.
Oh, go ahead. Finish.
Okay. So if state A and state B, and all these states are connected by wires, if state A and state B have different allowance prices because EPA used a different cost to determine the budget, if they have different allowance prices, A is 500, B is 100, the power plants in B are going to be able to run more cheaply. And what does that mean? That means they're going to run more. And when they run more, they're going to emit more pollution because the allowance prices are cheaper than running the controls, and the downwind air impacts are going to go up, up. So one of the flaws with the argument that we heard on behalf of Texas, and I think you were getting at this, Judge Kavanaugh, in your questions, is, well, you know, but it says 100 would do it for Texas. Well, 100 might do it for Texas, assuming that's true, and that was in the proposed model, rule modeling, and there were all sorts of problems with that I won't get into. But assuming that was true, it also assumed that everybody else was doing 100 too. And we know that 100 isn't enough for everybody else to do, right? So when Texas was doing 100, the state next to it was doing 100, and so the power plants in Texas weren't any cheaper than the power plants in Louisiana or the power plants in Arkansas or and so on and so forth all across the CASPER region. So uniformity plays this role of assuring that when a uniform cost is used, a uniform allowance price will be yielded, and those states will then be able to trade with each other.
I mean, you make a compelling policy argument, but the obviously in the court's decision, the Supreme Court's decision, that did not carry the day for eliminating the possibility of as-applied challenges, which are necessarily, I think, inconsistent with uniformity, because the as-applied challenge means you're going to get out from under the uniform cost threshold that otherwise you would have to comply with.
That's absolutely not true.
Okay.
As-applied challenges embrace far more than just challenges based upon the uniform cost used by EPA. The budgets that states have, which reflect, they're sort of the mirror image of the amount of pollution that contributes significantly to non-attainment or interferes with maintenance. The budgets that states have are a product of two things, the methodology and the application of the methodology to the facts. And the Supreme Court upheld unequivocally the methodology here, starting with a uniform cost, using that in the statutory scheme to define what the amount is in 110. And the translation of that to budget, though, actually operates through an enormous filter of facts. And those facts include for every power plant where it is, what kind of fuel it uses, what its efficiency is, what the emissions are, what its emission controls are, what its cost of operation is. Because that information has been aggregated at, you know, immense effort, in part by EPA and its information collection requests, but also in part by the private sector, the company called ICF that developed the IPM, the integrated planning module that we're really talking about. And if that's it, you know, if the budget assumption, the uniform cost assumption is the hot water, and the budget's the tea, well, that big tea bag in the middle that filters through all that hot water and turns the water into tea is the IPM model and all of its factual assumptions. Now, the petitioners acknowledge that, and indeed that was a big part of their as-applied challenges, right, that there can be errors in that factual matrix through which the uniform cost assumption is filtered. And, in fact, on page 27, turning dross into gold, of the industry and labor reply brief, they point out to these rules that have succeeded the cross-state air pollution rule and changed budgets because of information that has been brought to EPA's attention of places in which that teabag had erroneous information in it and therefore yielded different results. So those as-applied challenges are completely consistent with the notion that EPA can start with that uniform cost that is so important to making the plan go and work in a way that aligns with rather than conflicts with the way that electric power is generated and transmitted throughout the country. To circle back to those references, I see I'm grievously out of time, and I apologize.
Oh, please continue.
The information that you were looking for, Judge Rogers, about an explanation from EPA's lips in the rulemaking about why having different control costs mandates isolation between trading groups, which is something that we've raised in our briefs too, is found on 48263, where EPA, not so much talking about the cost assumptions and the importance of uniformity, but talking about why it needs to segregate Group 1 and Group 2 states.
Right.
Because, and those, you know, that discusses why it has to happen. If a state in which a $2,300 per ton price was used to generate allowances, those allowances are going to be sort of presumed to have a price of about $2,300, is in trading with a state that has a $500 allowance price, that's going to shift the emissions to the state with a $500 allowance price because it's so much cheaper to run the power there, and that state's going to emit more pollutants. Or the state which has a $2,300 a ton burden, if it bought, you know, its own allowances, could buy the allowances from the $500 state. Well, those allowances are going to be emitted in the state which has the higher emissions to begin with and yield those problems. So that's discussed there.
So it boils down to, as I understand what you're saying, is that somewhat
that the as-applied challenges that the Supreme Court has said are to be made available are matters that should be addressed to the agency, not this court.
That's
right. In
other
words, I understood counsel's argument on the legal interpretation of the Supreme Court's opinion, but just focusing on the as applied, that because of the factual matrix that you have pointed out, these are matters that the agency has to take into account. And a state, hypothetically the Texas state argument, it may get a budget that's different. But we don't know, based on the information that we have in the record, that EPA would have concluded under the transport rule that the Madison receptor would attain with only a $100 budget rather than a $500 budget measure. I mean, that's what I hear you telling me, that this is complex matter, that while you can agree on what the Supreme Court said, the application may not be as simplistic as my questions may have implied.
That's correct, Your Honor. If the I'll talk in a minute about what Texas budget is today, because that budget is not before this court. But the as applied, the implication that an as-applied challenge equals a challenge to the uniform cost rule is just wrong. There's no need for this court to conclude that, and there's no indication by the Supreme Court that that was what it meant. What the Supreme Court said is, talked about was not its amount. In these limiting factors, the Supreme Court didn't talk about whether or not this was an amount of pollution that interferes with maintenance or contributes substantially to downwind attainment. The Supreme Court talked about, in these carve-outs, lowering the budget to a point which was beneath that which was necessary for the downwind state to achieve maintenance or attainment. So it's targeted to a level of air quality. It's not targeted to the amount calculation. That's not what the court linked it to, which is where the uniform cost assumption comes in. And second of all, that's before we even get to the qualification.
That last sentence, it's not linked to the.
So the Supreme Court reasoning, as I understand it, reconciling these sections as best as I can, Your Honor, is that the Supreme Court concluded that EPA was reasonable in deciding that it would determine what the amount of pollution that an upwind state emits that contributes substantially to downwind non-attainment or interferes with maintenance. It would make the determination of that amount by using uniform cost, and the court said that's reasonable. And then later, in this section that we're focused on in this decision, because it has to do with as-applied challenges, it talks about reducing a state being forced to reduce its contribution, to reduce its emissions to a point that's more than is necessary to achieve attainment. So we started with endorsing EPA's view of looking at cost as determining the amount, and then we changed over to look at to check the outcome of that analysis against the actual air quality standards and see what it does. And as Mr. McCann pointed out, and as Ms. O'Donnell pointed out, there's a lot of linkages between even as it would perhaps characterize itself as the you know, one receptor state, or the lone receptor state, maybe, to as Texas, you know, the Texas is connected not just to Madison, but to all the states that contribute to Madison, and so on and so forth down the road.
So on and so forth, I don't understand.
Well, I mean, that all
Texas,
those states also
Texas
have burdens.
Texas is linked to Madison for the PM.
For the PM, that's right, and then to Michigan and Louisiana for the others. But the And Mr. McCann addressed that, as did Ms. O'Donnell, the need to treat states in like situations in like ways. But I don't want to get too far away from the uniformity point that I'm trying to make in the analysis of the Supreme Court decision. when the state is looking at its receptors in that regard, the state is going to be, excuse me, the court is going to have to find an air quality reason to release Texas from its obligations. The final thing I want to say before I sit down is this. I got some good news for you. Of the four states that the petitioners, industry and labor petitioners, point to, three of them all have new budgets already, subsequent rulemakings. So the budgets that are being challenged here on an as-applied basis are moot. The numbers have changed. Two subsequent rulemakings, actually both of which are cited on page 27 of the industry and labor petitioner's reply. So the court has a very simple approach to those in its remedy. They're moot. And with respect to the 14 states that the petitioners allege based upon this 2014 modeling, first of all, apparently today is 2012. In terms of the regulatory scheme imposed by this statute, the scheme that's in place today and the budgets that are in place today were intended to remedy the conditions in 2012. But more importantly, as a matter of law, all of those areas that were in 2014 that petitioners point to some modeling and says EPA predicted that they would be in attainment in 2014, as a matter of law, all of those areas, all of those receptors are in non-attainment unless and until they are redesignated by EPA in accordance with the procedures in Section 107. And until that time, monitoring results don't matter. They're in non-attainment. They stay in non-attainment until they are pulled out. There may be a remedy for states. Once they are redesignated through the process, once they are determined to be in attainment, states then, not only the states in which those receptors are, but upwind states who can maintain that that's their only link to the program, could file a new SIP or otherwise receive relief through a petition to EPA. This is a matter of public health, and this case demonstrates, if it demonstrates nothing, this case demonstrates how difficult it is to bring into effect regulation of these types of interstate pollution problems. And this court should not mistake a prediction that EPA made in 2010 when it was preparing the final rule and 2011 for attainment, because that's a very different legal thing. This is addressed on page 6 of our brief and was addressed, again, by Mr. McCann in his argument. I thank the panel very much for its indulgence with this extra time.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All right.
Your Honor, if I may, I'd like to address 4 points. I'd like to talk about Texas and Madison and what's been said about that, about the ozone states. I'd like to talk about uniform cost thresholds and what's been said about that. And also, Judge Kavanaugh, I'd like to address the point you raised about whether there's a tension in the Supreme Court's decision, because while we lost some aspects of that and therefore, in a sense, would disagree with some portions of it that aren't at issue here, I think it actually all does hang together and that the tension Your Honor refers to isn't there. But to begin with Texas and Madison, EPA counsel pointed out that Texas isn't the only upwind state linked to Madison, and that's right. There are others, and they've been controlled at higher levels, because even though EPA found that Madison would attain if every upwind state linked to it was controlled at $100 a ton, these other states, like Kentucky, are also linked to different downwind locations, which require more reductions.
I think Judge... I can't speak for Judge Kavanaugh, but I think we got your legal argument and opening, and I'd be interested in your response to what we just heard.
Sure. I mean, I think everything that Mr. Collins said is about the need to have, you know, a broader market for trading. There is no statutory requirement that there be trading. There is a statutory requirement to avoid over-control.
I'm sorry, I wasn't clear.
Okay.
In other words, where does this decision get made initially?
In other words,
when the Supreme Court talks about as applied, one might think that the matter would go back to the agency, let whenever state wants to come in and talk to the agency about its budget, the agency would make a decision, and then
who knows, we might be back here again, but that that would be the procedural posture as distinct from trying to decide anything about these as-applied challenges at this stage for some of the reasons that were just discussed and also discussed by EPA counsel.
Yes, Your Honor. The remand that the Supreme Court ordered was the one that Deputy Solicitor General Malcolm Stewart said would be appropriate in response to the questions from Justice Sotomayor and Chief Justice Roberts. And that portion of the transcript is very clear. He was saying that that would be a remand to the Court of Appeals to consider as-applied challenges.
That's but that often happens, as you probably know better than I. They send it back to the Circuit Court of Appeals. And then often the case may go back to the agency or even to, you know, a district court.
And certainly our vision of this, Your Honor, is that this does go back to the agency for more proceedings to determine the proper emissions budgets. But the question is whether there is an intermediate step in which this court articulates the legal principles that need to guide that remand. And there are very substantial legal disputes here.
I understand that. And I thought that was the thrust of your opening argument, candidly.
Yes. Right. And so there would be a remand except for those 14 ozone states. And, you know, with respect to those 14 ozone states, our position is just very simple. EPA projected that in 2014, those downwind locations wouldn't need any good neighbor controls. Ms. O'Donnell says they didn't base their budgets on those projections. But that's our complaint. There are facts in the record which show no good neighbor controls were necessary, but EPA nonetheless imposed reductions. The fact that they didn't base their budgets on the projections they made is not a justification. It's exactly what's wrong with what happened below. With respect to uniform cost thresholds, Judge Rogers, you're absolutely right. There are no uniform cost thresholds right now. There are two groups with two different cost thresholds, and that's because EPA said in the rulemaking, and we quote this on page 7 of our reply brief, we believe it is appropriate to use multiple thresholds where one group of states can, for a lower cost, eliminate non-attainment and maintenance for all the downwind areas to which they're linked, which is exactly...
Right, but that's not inconsistent with what we just heard, that there is a theory of uniform cost controls consistent with what EPA has done by grouping states in a manner such that... depending on the level of correction still needed, it makes sense to group in that matter.
And Your Honor, if we were coming in here saying Texas should instead be regulated at $495 a ton, we're not saying that. We're talking about the difference between $500 a ton and $100 a ton. We're talking about the difference between 14 states which are regulated. Florida has to cut more than 25% of its NOx budget. It shouldn't be regulated at all. This isn't in that margin where they get leeway. This is way outside that. And the only other thing I'd like to address, Judge Kavanaugh, is your point about the tension in the opinion, because I do think the opinion is internally consistent in the following sense. If you look at Section 2B, where the Supreme Court addressed proportionality, what it was saying is that uniform cost thresholds can be used to allocate that increment by which states have to reduce in order to enable downwind locations to attain. But every numerical example it gave made clear that you first decide what is that increment, that minimum necessary to reduce in order to enable the downwind locations to attain and maintain the NACs. Once you establish that over-control ceiling, then yes, you use uniform cost thresholds to allocate that among the states. But then when they got to Section 2C, they said, we recognize that uniform cost thresholds does leave open the possibility that there will be over-control, and that's to be addressed in as-applied challenges. And I think what's going on here is that, you know, the court determined that there is this ceiling that has to be observed through as-applied challenges, and once that's observed, then the remainder that needs to be reduced can be allocated using uniform cost thresholds. What's happened here is that we have accepted the part of the decision that we lost on proportionality, and we have no longer argued, obviously, that you cannot allocate that overage uniformly, instead have to do it proportional to each state's fiscal contribution. But EPA has not accepted the proposition that there is this other limit, the part of the decision that they lost, which says that if EPA requires an upwind state to reduce emissions by more than is necessary to enable every downwind location to which it is linked to attain the NAAQS, it has overstepped its authority.
But can you address, Ms. O'Donnell talked about ripple effects in Texas?
Yeah, there are no ripple effects that I understand here. Recall that EPA found that if all of the upwind states linked to Madison were regulated at $100 a ton, Madison would attain. So when people refer to ripple effects or free riding, there's no free riding. Texas, at $100 a ton, reduces the entirety of its significant contribution. Madison, we know, still attains and maintains the NAAQS, because that's what EPA has said. It said if everyone's regulated at $100 a ton, they attain and maintain. So there are no ripple effects to Madison. As Ms. O'Donnell said, it's possible Madison's air quality will be slightly
ripple
worse.
Ripple effects in Texas, I think. In other words, with a lower...
Well, but if it's Texas, then it's not a subject of the good neighbor provision. That's about effects of one state on another state. There are a whole bevy of other provisions that control what Texas has to do to control its own emissions. And by the way, no other upwind state has to do any more because Texas is reduced to $100 a ton. They're doing what they're doing, as Your Honors noted, because they're linked elsewhere. So there's no free riding. Texas reduces its significant contribution. The downwind location attains the NAAQS, and other states do what they have to do.
I guess my concern here, counsel, is you and I just heard an explanation of the uniform cost theory and how, in fact, it works in terms of ultimately setting up budgets. And it's not a simple calculus we can sort of pull one state out of the uniform threshold and get the same result. It may work out that way, but the only question is, can this court make that determination? Or I get your point about saying EPA didn't even take into account its own figures. Right. That's one thing. So you get the remand. But how can we go further than that?
Well, and as I indicated in the first round in response to Your Honor's question, we're not saying the court should direct $100 a ton.
Yeah.
So if there's something EPA wants to say in the remand, it can, and that will be tested through the process.
But that wouldn't be true, as I understand your argument, as to the 14 states.
Well, that's right.
Arizona.
Because on that, the projection is just crisp and clear, and they've given no explanation. You know, I mean, the other thing to say, Your Honor, is that the answer to everything we've said has been, this is a seamless web. You pull one thread, everything dissolves. Everything is exactly perfect the way it is. And if you just jostle it a little bit, the whole world is going to come crashing down. This is not the way it is because it's a seamless, carefully crafted web. It's the way it is because they did not believe they had any obligation to avoid over-control. And so there are lots of states where, because they didn't look at it, they over-controlled based on their own data. Nothing we're saying with respect to at least the first four states would preclude them from saying on remand that there's some factor that they haven't identified. But with respect to the 14 states, you have a record which says no good neighbor controls are needed. You have to vacate the budgets there, we think. If the court has no further questions.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
No further.
We done?
Are we done? All right. We will take the case under advisement. Thank you, counsel.